John McEwen should be a very familiar name to you. He's been a guest on this program many times. First, just because he was a great guest, he came back on to discuss the 40th anniversary of the original Will the Circle Be Unbroken album. Then we also talked in depth about his award-winning album, Made in Brooklyn. John now has a great book. The title of the book is The Life I've Picked, A Banjo Player's Nitty-Gritty Journey. We're going to talk to John in the second hour about that book and the journey around it. A lot of things that aren't in the book are going to come up. And this will be part one. Part two will be next week. Yes, there's a lot to cover from the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, John's beginning, and his time with the band, and his time since then as the String Wizard. And he continues on and does so well. Fine book. You're going to enjoy hearing from John. I'm always happy to have as a guest on Unreal Bluegrass, John McEwen, the String Wizard. How are you, John?
Oh, thank you. I'm good. Nice to be here.
Hey, I want to talk about your book, and we've talked about a lot of things. But first of all, I want to say congratulations. The Made in Brooklyn recording just picked up a nice award.
I was shocked, Steve. It was totally unknown to me when I got this notice that it's nominated for Best Americana Album at the Independent Music Awards. And it won. I couldn't believe it.
Mm-hmm. That's the last time you and I talked on the show, and I've met you since then, but was about that record coming out on Chesky.
Uh-huh.
And just a really is a big, nice big, all the information you could want. You still have a lot of it in the book here to describe, but we talked about it at length. And everything we do, John, on the show is on unrealbluegrass.com. There's 2.5 hours of conversation with you stored there in the archive under M. If you ever want to listen to yourself, I can't imagine that you would. I don't listen to myself. I can't do it. I can't go back and do it.
I don't either.
Good. Well, all right. Someday. Listen. The reason that I wanted to talk to you now, and when we set this up, the award hadn't come down for the Made in Brooklyn CD, but the book was coming out, and I was getting ready to get a copy of your new, I'll call it a biography to date, because you're still producing and still very active. But it's The Life I've Picked, A Banjo Journey. A Banjo Player's Nitty Gritty Journey, and it's on Chicago Preview Press. John, I've read it. It's a wonderful. You know, I knew this would be a good book because I've talked to you enough.
Thank you.
I've talked to you enough to know that you're a good storyteller. Now, that doesn't always relate to being a good print storyteller, but you do it. You make it work so well.
Well, thank you, Steve. I worked a long time on this. I basically have been writing stories for the last 15 years. And kind of geared it up a little more 10 years ago and 8 years ago. And thanks to Steve Martin, the comedian, actor, banjo player, playwright, a lifelong friend, as you know.
Yeah.
He was saying, you have a book here, but it's not a book yet. And so I worked on it a couple more years and then went and found an agent, and he tried to shop it for a while, and then he dropped it, and then I found another agent. He found a publisher, and then I took like 85 stories that I had that were just, each one was okay by itself. But when you tried to put them together, the timeline was so jarring, I couldn't even read it. I'd get lost, you know. One story would go with a certain person, like Leon Russell, from 1966 through 2010. And the next story would go from 1972 to 2001. And the next one would just be somewhere between 77, well, like the Russian chapter. That deserved its own chapter.
Absolutely.
The Circle album deserved its own chapter.
Yep, no question.
But there were things about that needed to show up in the timeline later on. And so it was really fun to fillet it and then try to find things in between that would pop up.
When I read this, John, I started thinking, how in the world, because this goes back to really, well, easily not, you know, well, it goes back to high school, and then you had a friend that you've discussed already, Steve Martin, and things, but also even before that, how did you have all these notes, how did you have all these stories handy? And that's what I was thinking as I'm reading. This goes back with a lot of detail, and you and I have talked a lot, and I'm a fan of your music, and I've seen you do the movie, the film presentation of the trip to Russia, which is represented in the book, and also the Dillard's movie, which is also mentioned in the book. But how did you remember these things to go back so far in the early 60s when you're just starting out? There's a lot of detail.
Well, there's a situation where like when the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band years, I was road manager for 10 years. So I was taking notes and booking hotels and flights and keeping track of things and reviews. Out of all the guys in the band, I probably have more memorabilia stuff than all of the other guys together. You know, my mother collected every newspaper clipping that she could find and put it in books. So you can kind of remember things. Oh, I remember this. And then when you do a lot of interviews, which I've done over 10,000 interviews over the years, and that was one of the things, I have interviewers maybe 20 years ago saying, you ought to write a book. Yeah. Oh, that's a funny story. And then 10 years ago and 8 years ago, you ought to put these in a book. You ought to write a book. Rock, rock, you ought to write a book. And the doing the interviews, though, would keep the memories alive because people would say, well, what was it like with Vassar Clements, you know? Or what was it like when you played with Steve Martin at such and such? Or what was it like when you went to Russia? And there were things about those that I'd taken notes on a lot of things over the years. And I had notes, and I had reviews, and had videotape that I collected, and it all helped with everything.
John,
and I would like to say, I think another aspect that was in my favor was that I never got into drugs. I couldn't do it. I just didn't smoke weed or anything. I don't mind that others did, unless it was when we were going to be working, performing. I think it has no place in the concert area. Do it after the show, but that's another issue. But I'm just glad I didn't lose track of some of the things. And then I had kids. You know, when you have children, you can't be screwing around. You have to feed them or they're going to die.
Allegedly, they'll die if you don't feed them. We haven't really pushed that to the limits yet, though, I don't think. Yeah.
But, you know, you can have a cat, and you can leave it for a few days, and it'll go find a lizard or something.
That's right.
Your kids can't forage.
That's true. Here's a thing that I just want to tell you, and I want to talk about the book. I don't want to give away all the – there's so many great stories. And
I don't mind if you because I couldn't put all of the stories.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. How do you pare it down? That's like 313 pages, and then you have acknowledgments, a lot of pictures in the middle. But of all the things that you talk about, I know that you had to make some effort in the book to pare it down to this because you must have had just reams and reams of notes and boxes of memorabilia and stories, all of which are keyed by those things that you've kept. How do you make the cut? You had to have cut the content to get it this small, relatively speaking.
I would cut a piece of content and see if I reread the story a month later, if I missed anything.
Okay.
And I most often wouldn't. Like, I don't think I talk about Leon Russell's son, Teddy Jack Eddy, in the book, do I?
No.
Yeah, well, see, I had that story. One night I'm walking back from Kinko's in Nashville, after sending emails and transferring some photos, heading back to my lonely hotel room, and somebody starts yelling, John McEwen! And I'm going, oh, I wonder what this will be. He goes, it's me, Teddy Jack. My dad and I just got off the road. Come on out to the house. I said, Teddy Jack, it's like 12:30. Well, you know Leon. He's up. And I will call him first. So I ended up at Leon Russell's house, and we're down in the basement an hour later recording the song that I started playing the guitar. He goes, I never heard you play guitar like that. Let me put some piano with that. Okay, now do a mandolin, and I'll put on some drums. And, you know, we ended up recording a thing called Way Back in History.
Uh-huh.
And that was really cool. And Teddy Jack, TJ, as he goes by, was a great engineer. He works a lot with my son, Jonathan, now, out in Ventura.
Well, in your book, you talk about your son, Jonathan. As toward the end of the book, you talk about him, you know, pursuing a career and having some guitar playing skills and different things like that. So that's interesting that they've worked together.
Well, Jonathan, over the years, worked at it, went out to Ventura to make his own headway, and he became Dave Mason's favorite guitar player.
That's saying a lot because if I were to pick out my five, you know, of course, during the time I grew up, traffic and all the stuff that Dave was doing, Dave Mason is one of my top five guitar players that I like to pull out.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Dave had Jonathan play lead on his album, 26 Letters and 12 Notes, and sing harmony, and he recorded one of his songs.
Wow.
it was wonderful when Jonathan called me and told me what was happening there. And he's a highly respected player, plays with a lot of people. Alan Parsons is mixing some of his songs right now.
No kidding.
Because he likes the music for no money.
John, you throughout this book, and this, and if anybody knows you or knows of your music, I think this book brings into focus a couple things for me, at least. Not only do you, not only are you a working musician, you love music, you're a fan of music, and you're a fan of musicians, and you're a fan of life.
I would say that last one is especially true. There's been several times when I should have been dead, and I'm not, so I better do something with it. You know, various accidents and things
right.
that could have happened.
And you chronicle some of those in the book.
And it's just amazing to me that I'm here and I can do this. So I better do it. Otherwise, I'd be abusing whatever abilities I have. And one of the problems, you mentioned Steve the newsman.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when people read that chapter, I was really glad to run into a guy that was what we called then crippled. He was handicapped, but he was all hunched over his moped type of bike, covered with newspapers, every basket and the handlebars and basket and everything. And he's trudging up La Cienega Boulevard at 6 in the morning. I'm heading to an airplane in 1967 to go fly out and go to another job in those early years. And I'm thinking, oh, this is a hard job. And I see this guy, and it's like, oh, my God, that guy's going to fall over. No, he didn't fall over. He made it to the top of La Cienega. I know that guy. I've seen him selling newspapers at the restaurant in different places. This guy made his own life. He was about as knocked down as a person can be, yet he found a business. And he probably made a lot of money, too, because he was selling newspapers. And people knew his name. Oh, yeah, I remember Steve, poor bastard. And I always gave him an extra buck or two. And he would get into the major agencies and the record company presidents and buy a newspaper from him every day. He got into places that everybody in Hollywood was trying to get into. You know? And I think I like the closing line on that story, that he had something from all of us that most of us didn't have for each other, and that was respect.
Yeah.
That here was a guy. You could not complain when you saw this guy going down Sunset Boulevard at 7 in the morning. You know, it's there but for fortune go you or I,
and,
as shown by us said.
Yeah, and throughout the book, you come back, he's kind of a touchstone, because there are some dark parts, not a lot, but you do have some run-ins, and the accidents that you were talking about a little bit, I think that you maybe some other ones not too, but in the book there are things that, yeah, but for an inch here or a foot there, you know, worse things would have happened. But you do kind of come back to Steve the newsman. You mention him every once in a while, and as you're closing the book out, you kind of reference him again. So I think that it's great that you can find one thing like that to always come back to, and one person like that that's inspirational, and because you know.
And it is something that can keep you going when you think, I mean, when you think things are tough, turn on the news and look at what the people in Syria are having to do.
Man.
I don't mean the ISIS people.
Right.
I mean the really nice families that are being forced out, or anywhere in the world, you know. And, you know, and it's so funny. Isn't the world history a strange thing? And now Vietnam is a great vacation spot. People
yeah.
say, hey, I'm going to go to Vietnam this summer. You know?
I'll tell you, John, I had a little brother who was visiting in that part of the world, and he's texting me. This was years ago. And
yeah.
he's in Vietnam. He's on a train to go to Cambodia, and I text back, we're not allowed to go to Cambodia, because my mind was still thinking, don't go there. Only Nixon can go to Cambodia. My little brother can't go there.
But yeah, when I was a kid, you couldn't go to Cambodia unless you were bombing it.
That's right. This book covers, I've talked about it just a little bit, and I'll get into a little bit with you, but you know, from your I didn't know this, although I know you fairly well from just encounters like this and being a fan, and I know Steve from similar contacts on the program. I knew you knew each other, but I didn't know you were connected to the Magic Castle together. That was kind of a surprise.
Magic Shop,
I'm sorry.
Yeah, in Disneyland.
Yeah.
We were both trying to get a job in the Magic Shop at 17 years old. and hanging out. And it was funny. I don't know if this got edited out or not. I can't remember. Mm-hmm. But the first time Steve Martin and I had lunch together was in Tomorrowland.
I think it is in there.
I mean, it's really ominous. And we're talking about, if we could just get this magic shop job.
That's right.
That'd be cool, wouldn't it? Yeah. And we did. We worked at the magic shop for 3 years. And he was up in Merlin's most of the time, Merlin's Magic Shop in Fantasyland. And, you know, and the people that are listening know that Steve Martin has made not just a lot of money, but boxes and boxes of it because of his hard work over the years. He's always working on something.
When he's working, I'll put it this way, when he's working, he's working. When he's working on a project and he's got his sights he's focused on that like you know him 100 million times better. But just my brief encounters, if it's talking about music on this program, it's talking about the music that he's into. And in a sense, that's his work. And he gets very focused.
And his acting work would help pay for his music work.
Yeah.
So he could afford to buy more paintings.
And buy more art so he could sell and buy more art. I know. It's just anyway. I didn't mean to distract you.
Yet here we were. We had lunch last week in New York, and he wanted to make sure we were going to have the lunch appointment. And it was really funny that 15 minutes into it, he goes, "I got a new card trick." He couldn't wait to.
Really?
You can't do a card trick for yourself in the mirror. You have to do it for someone.
That's right.
You know, and here he was all excited about a new card trick. Not the play Meteor Shower that just posed on Broadway and is going all over the country that got great reviews.
Right.
No. But that's the card trick was important. He did it great, too. I'm going to learn it. I know it. I know how to do it, but I don't have... Anyway, that's a different issue. He emailed me once last September. He emailed me, "Look what I got on eBay." Now, here's a guy... Now, it's public record things like somebody buys a big painting. It's a public record if they pay $12 million for it.
Right.
It's also a public record when they sell it for $18
million. Right.
And that's what he did with the Picasso. He didn't tell me that. That didn't matter to our relationship. That's what he does with art. But what really mattered to him was what he found on eBay. And he sent me a picture. It was the signboard that hung outside of Merlin's Magic Shop.
Oh, no kidding.
In Fantasyland. He was excited about that as a toy under the tree at Christmas. You know, a toy train under the tree.
Your life and your connection with Steve starts off there at Disneyland. And then he kind of weaves in throughout, not just through the book, but I think through your life and even to the more recent, we started off talking about the Maid in Brooklyn. He comes back through that again. So you do sort of intersect throughout through this life that you're living and you
kind
of...
One of the things, like when he got his first two NBC specials, I did the music for him, and that was
right.
Fun.
That's right.
And then a couple other things. And he did a video routine with me once that I used on Nashville Now in the 80s. And we've kind of interacted, and maybe not a year would even go by. We wouldn't talk, but when we pick up the phone, it's like where we left off.
And were you the producer for The Crow?
Yes.
Yeah.
I arranged the music, and I went to him. I said, "Steve, you have an album here. You need to write 4 more songs, though." "Well, I don't know. I said, "Yeah, write 4 more. I don't think you should be doing your version of Pretty Polly or something. It needs to be all Steve Martin music. And I know how to produce a record on you because I know what your favorite music is. Appalachian Spring by Aaron Copland, The Music Man, Flatten Scruggs' Original Sound of Bluegrass, Keith and Rooney's Living on the Mountain album." Let's just say those 4. "And I know how that mix can apply to your music." And he says, "Okay, let's do it."
And then that was a Grammy winner, wasn't it? That was kind of like Steve's first venture back into playing bluegrass to be recorded.
His first music album.
Yeah.
And yes, it won a Grammy.
Yeah. And if you're just tuning in, I'm talking to John McEwen, who's been a frequent contributor to Unreal Bluegrass, for which I'm always appreciative, John. And we're talking about a lot of things, and we're kind of swirling about your brand-new book, The Life I Picked, A Banjo Player's Nitty-Gritty Journey. And we started where it started, and that's what we got off talking about, Steve. The Nitty-Gritty Dirt Band takes up a huge chunk. in bits. There's a piece here, there's another piece, there's a broken timeline with them, which you get into in details to how that occurred and how it came back together again. But the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band has a place in history, maybe not always entirely happy, but there's a place in history for Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. When you and I have talked about this before, I don't know that there would have been a band like that. Certainly a band like that today doesn't exist as far as the airwaves, I don't think.
No, I don't hear them out there. I mean, one of my favorite albums was Uncle Charlie.
Right.
Because you had to play it over and over to get the... And that's when I made Made in Brooklyn. I was trying to make an album like Uncle Charlie, where I've had many people tell me, gladly, you know, I played the record, and it got to the end of it. I couldn't remember what I'd heard, but I knew I really liked number two, and I think number six. And then I played it, and I found out it was, number four and five. And then I had to play it again, and it wasn't four and five. It was seven and nine, you know, whatever. You know, it goes on a journey. It's not one song to a next song to the next song with the same thing going on. But there's a string of acoustic credibility that runs through it. And that's what Uncle Charlie had. It was Kenny Loggins' first recordings of House of Two Corner, and Kenny Loggins' first recording of any of his music, Santa Rosa, Prodigal's Return. And that's even when some of the consternation started for me, because I tried to get Jeff to sing Danny's song, because I recorded a demo of it in my apartment in Hollywood, and that's what we were learning his songs from. And Jeff said, well, it's too much of a hippie song, that Pisces Virgo rising verse. Well, leave it out. And it's funny, strange enough, Anne Murray left it out and had a smash with it.
Yes, she did.
I think Jeff Hanna could have killed that song.
He could have. And then, since you're talking about that and Kenny Loggins, and you're going to have to get the book, people listening, because we're touching on half of 1% of the stories and the content. But when you talk about Kenny Loggins, he pitched another song that did pretty well, and it wound up being the beginning, I guess, of Jim Messina, and Kenny Loggins kind of went off on their own, and I guess Jim was in Poco then, about that time.
After Poco.
Was it after Poco?
After Buffalo Springfield, Messina went to become a producer, and I was in the studio when he was mixing the Poco album, but people listening, it was a different time. The old regime was still running Hollywood, meaning the record companies and the movie business. And, you know, George Lucas didn't really have any credibility yet, things like that. So I'm watching him mix, and he's saying to the engineer, a track three, that's the bass, can you push it up a little bit, like 2 dB? And the guy says, well, it's almost hitting the red now. And Jim says, but this is 256 tape, and it can take a plus three hit. You know, he knew more about what the guy was running, but he wasn't union. He couldn't touch the
board. Oh, I see. So and if it's in the red, it's going to be clipping, and the sound is going to be...
Fear of clipping. Well, let it clip and then bring it down. You know, you couldn't talk like that. You couldn't push something on the edge of distortion. And could you put the part of the background vocals on the right, some on the left? Well, they're background vocals. They should be over here on the right. You know, things that were just rules, you know.
Well, go ahead.
Messina and I, he lived in Laurel Canyon, up on Laurel Canyon Boulevard, and I was up the hill on Lookout Mountain. And I go down to his place and play chess a couple times and sit and play guitar. So we had a relationship, kind of. You know, we knew each other, highly respected him. And he called me up once and said, hey, Kenny and I just made a demo that I think would be perfect for the Dirt Band. And I brought Jeff up there, and of course this is in more detail in the book, but the short of it is, we drove away with Jeff Hanna saying, I don't want to do that. It's anybody can write a song that goes, your mama don't dance and your daddy don't rock and roll. I don't think it's a hit.
Yeah.
So I called Kenny up the next day, and he says, well, thanks for listening. I called Jimmy. And he said, But Kenny and I might put this out ourselves just to see what happens.
Why not? See if anybody likes it. Boy, did they ever. the formation of the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, John, I was glad to read this book because you have this, you know, and I listened to it all as it was coming out. I remember it all. But from the outside looking in, it most people, or at least I did, would think it was a continuous straight line. Instead of, you get exposure on a record, and throughout the book you're talking about, hey, we're getting close, but then nothing really takes off huge. You mentioned when something really hits big, it has to do with a certain radio station in New York and a show that you did at a Catholic girls' school, which I love the way that works out. But it seems like a straight line, but really it's as successful in retrospect as the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band was. There were stops and starts even when you were still hitting it full time.
There are for everybody. A lot more than people know. I'm sure you may not recall the ones, but you've heard about groups that they just get a platinum album and they break up because they're bankrupt.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, that happens. The music business is very expensive to be in. And there's people after that money. The lawyers at the record company do not work for the artists. They work for the record company.
That's right.
And there was a contract we signed one time for United Artists that said, the rights discussed herein are held by the company until the world as we know it shall cease to exist. Now, that's a long time.
Well, yes, in theory it's a long time.
Years and years later, that was determined to be used.
Are you serious? They actually had those words in the contract.
Yeah, that was the last
part. Oh, I thought you were just exaggerating, because you're a good writer, John. I thought this was something that you would. Okay.
That was in the contract.
I've never heard of that.
The company retains these rights until the world as we know it shall cease to exist.
It seems extreme.
You'd sign it.
Well, sure.
We'll get us our deal. You're going to put out the album.
You're going to get on the radio, and then it's like, yeah. Here we go. And but there were struggles, even though the rest of the world were hearing, we were hearing all these great songs from the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. There were struggles getting from gig to gig.
1979.
Yeah.
Steve, 1979, we put out a song that I started with the Dobro and Jeff's guitar. It was American Dream. Voila, an American Dream. You know that song?
Mm-hmm.
I beg your pardon. What did you say? And written by Rodney Crowell. He sent us a cassette with that on it. The cassette sounded like a hit. So it's coming out and it's doing well. I mean, it's out and it's doing well. My brother's managing. And he goes to the promotion.
That's your brother, Bill?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Who produced many of the albums. And did the covers, starting with the Circle, starting with Uncle Charlie. Bill McEwen was responsible for the look of the Dirt Band,
mm-hmm.
up until the Jealousy album, which he was not. That was a yellow, kind of a too much rock and roll kind of an album. That was the Dirt Band in a Spinal Tap phase. The way I think of
odd, it. Thinking back, but, it's an odd title for the album. Not when you read the book, don't you think? Unintended.
So America, here's how it was.
Okay.
1979, American Dream is on the radio in the top 20. It could make it to the top 10. We need a promotion man in the record company to get involved. And he goes, look, I'm not going to work this record unless you put $5,000 in cash or coke on my desk. And it's like, okay, well, my brother gave him the $5,000. The guy works for the record company, but he needed extra money. And it's that we had to go, Bill had to go find $5,000. And that put him working on the record and calling more stations and getting people to do favors. And it made it to the top 10. It made it to number 9, I think. But unfortunately, on the downside, none of the stations wanted to say Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, an American Dream. Because it sounded to them, I mean, imagine, you're at a radio station, you want to be cool, hip, and popular, and you say things like, that was Led Zeppelin, and right after that, we had an Aretha Franklin. And now here's something from the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. You know, it sounds like 1910 Fruit Gum Company.
Oh, no, okay.
You know what I mean?
I do now.
And here's something, the Troggs have a new hit. You know, it just didn't play. So okay. They didn't say anything. It was that and
Nitty
Blue. That and Jackie Blue were two of the most unidentified records. Remember Ozark Mountain Daredevil?
Yeah, Jackie Blue, yeah, sure.
Yeah. Well, their manager, Stan Plesser, told me years ago that it almost ruined their career. It was such a big record. And I said, I get it, Stan. He says, nobody wanted to say Ozark Mountain Daredevils and Jackie Blue. So people thought it was America or somebody.
I don't remember. I don't remember that not being said. But I guess I mean it makes sense. Why would they not? You were a fan,
so you knew the Daredevils, Jackie Blue.
Yeah.
But the record was on the radio for 6 months, and it seemed like the Ozark Mountain Daredevils were not on the radio for 6 months. You know, and it was good for fair bookings and certain things, but it wasn't that kind of record like a Creedence Clearwater. You knew. There's another problem with the Dirt Band, is there wasn't always an identifiable sound. There was a lot of good songs. And until Jimmy Fadden wrote, Jimmy Ibbotson wrote a couple of good point of view songs, but they were his point of view. Ibby asked me once, why is it I can't get people to record some of my songs? And I said, well, Jim, I think it's because all your songs are about you. Nobody wants to sing about you.
Here's another song about Jimmy Ibsen.
But they had a point of view about love, like Rippling Waters.
Yeah.
Okay. Dance Little Jean. Yeah. Dance Little Jean. I played a wedding for the money, and I wanted to tell the bride and groom. Very cool song. One of the better hits for the Dirt Band. And that's what got him back in the band. That's in the book about how I knew that would be a hit. Ibbotson was on what I like to call an I Hate Us. I'll repeat that. What I like to call an I Hate Us.
I heard it.
Yeah, audiences don't when I say that.
I heard it.
And then they go, oh, I get it. But he came back in, and that worked out. But until Jimmy Fadden wrote Working Man, that is the most point of view for the general public. I'm a working man. I want to be a working man. You know, and it's like a Springsteen song.
Yeah.
And, gosh, that was a great song, Jimmy Fadden. I wish you would have written another one like that. And other songs that would come along, some would be on the radio, but when we put out Don Slitz's song, I Love Only You, doing that on stage was like Snoozeville. It was number one, but it's one of those horrible things that can happen where you get more applause when the song starts than when it's over.
The book, you do a good job chronicling it. There were rough periods with the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band and the Dirt Band and different iterations of the music that was being done in your position. And I want people to read and really get into how you worked around it, and how you, the String Wizard, and all the things that you did in the music scores, and John, you're producing. You just never stopped. You never stopped through it all. You just kept producing music and loving music and you love musicians. You like to watch musicians play.
I like to produce things where you put a bunch of people together in a room and they're really good at doing what they do. And you tell them a few things to do, and you sit there and watch. And if they're good and they're doing it, that's cool.
Well,
one of my difficulties with the Dirt Band, I was never allowed to produce anything, put them together. How about this for an arrangement? How about a piece of my music? How about if this happens on this song? Nothing.
Yep.
So instead, I go record Vince Gill with the Nashville Symphony, things like that, you know? And I got that energy out there. And I'm grateful for the restrictions within the group, because keep in mind, I also know it's very hard for one guy in a band to say, I've got 10 songs I want to put on the next album. You know, even the other guys in the group didn't do that.
No.
You know. And Jeff, fortunately, picked some really good songs to sing. Mm-hmm. Thank God for Jimmy Ibbotson being the person that we found. When Jeff and I were watching Poco in a club during a six-month breakup after Paint Your Wagon, Jeff didn't want to do the band anymore with the people that were in it, and I didn't want to be in a band that didn't have him in it. So we're watching Poco, and I said, I think we said it to each other almost at the same time. Let's get the Dirt Band back together. So he went and talked to Jimmy Fadden, who was working in a clothing store, and I found Les Thompson, and then Jeff and I went and interviewed, kind of, Jimmy Ibbotson. And when they first met and sang together, it was like they even could tell it was magic, that their voices were such a blend. It was Everly Brother-ish, you know. And that's when that started. And Jimmy Ibbotson brought into the band such wonderful energy and new songs as the years went by, and stage energy that was not there before. And he and I worked off each other really, really well. Now, he also became difficult to work with thanks to the vagaries of life affecting some people one way and some another. And I, in retrospect, wish that we had sat him down and done an intervention or something. Look, we can't throw this away. We can't get rid of you. I don't want to, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It would have been good to keep that going. But it was easier to extract it. Say, Ibby, you can't be in the band anymore. You're too hard to get along with. Well, maybe it should have been said, he shouldn't be in the band with a bunch of people that didn't want to help him get along.
You're right.
You know, and I don't know the answer. But I do know that when he came back in, that energy was back, and with Dance Little Gene in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the kind of thing I really liked chronicling, because of some other people that are in the band, they never give him enough credit. To this day, in the last year that I played with the band, I think Jeff only mentioned when he would do Dance Little Gene or Rippling Waters, he'd only mention Ibby's name maybe 3 times in a year. And I just find that ridiculous. They'd mention Jackson Browne every chance they could, because he played 5 shows with the Dirt Band in 1966. You know, when there was no corporation, no record company, no group, really. They weren't getting paid.
I hope you enjoyed the first part. Come back next week. We will finish up discussing about his brand-new book, The Life I've Picked, A Banjo Player's Nitty-Gritty Journey. Thanks, John.